Okay, so it's really fun to be here, and I hope we'll have more fun this week. So I'm going to talk about single cell viability of growth in bacteria, and not all of the talk, but part of the talk is actually an introduction to what we're going to do in the lab for those who will be with us. So we are interested in growth of bacteria, not only of bacteria, but I'm going to talk about bacteria today. And actually, we are interested more specifically in the absence of growth. And so why the absence of growth? So in most of what we heard today, for example, if we heard about how people test antibiotic susceptibility, it's done on exponentially growing bacteria. Also, the growth loads that Terry has shown us are done at strictly exponential growth. And most of the, and this is very general, most of the microbiology work is done on exponentially growing bacteria. But it's well known that actually in the wild, bacteria are mostly in the growth arrested state. So some of these growth arrested state have been studied, such as sporulation, which is a very defined program, but most of the bacteria don't really have a defined program as far as we know for not growing. They are just there, nutrient depleted, and they are not growing. And the question, what can we say about this state? Yes. This was early.
So how do you know that most of them are in the dormant state? I mean, it seems very plausible, but is there actually, you know, hard data to back that up?
Okay, so first of all, if you take a sample from the soil or from the sea, from the gut, most of the bacteria that you can see there and you can detect by DNA don't grow when you put them even in a rich nutrient medium. So it's really difficult to get all these bacteria growing in the lab. That's the first observation. Second, people have done all kind of assay of putting in nutrients in the soil and then getting the bacteria and seeing if there is anything. Sporulating bacteria, for example, when you extract them from the soil, they are mostly in the spore state. So this is more or less the evidence that they are not growing over there. So why do we study the exponential growth? Actually, it's due to Jacques Monod and the work he did in his thesis. He really shifted that tension of the microbiology field to measure bacteria at exponential growth. Why? Because first he was very careful to measure it and to define how to measure bacteria growth and how to relate OD to bacterial mass, dry mass. But at the exponential growth, you have a very quantitative parameter that you can measure, which is a growth rate. And that's very nice to have. A growth rate is something that you can compare between a different experiment. It's also a global parameter that tells you, that really averages out many, many different processes in the cell, and it's a very robust output to measure. And for those that are interested in evolution, growth rate is a proxy for fitness. So this is a growth curve that that he defined. It is part of the growth curve that Monod defined. And as you can see, here is the exponential growth. But you can see that there are two phases, even in the lab, of bacteria growth, where the growth rate is actually zero. So this is the plot of the growth rate, and it goes down to zero at station phase and at the lag phase. And these are the two phases that we'd like to focus on. So first, we'll start with station phase. Just what is station phase? The growth rate is zero. This is how it's defined. But what does it mean that the growth rate is zero? Is stationary phase is the fact that the OD is constant here, a balance between growth and death, or are really bacteria frozen there? That's a very simple question, and even that is not totally characterized. So we wanted to really look directly at the single cell level at the stationary phase, namely put bacteria in under the microscope into stationary phase and look at them, maintain them at stationary phase and look at them and see whether they grow and die or whether they are just frozen. So clearly, it will also depend on the conditions in which you do it. But So what, the condition that we chose are minimal medium with supplemented with amino acids, and at a low enough level so that interaction between bacteria can be neglected. So we put them in microfluidic devices in order really to trap them. We have bacteria under observation, which are trapped on these lines where on the device that we've been using for many years now. And on top of these trapped bacteria, we have a semi-permeable membrane. And on top of all that, we have a microfluidic channel. So bacteria are constantly renewed with medium. But now, and in order to keep condition constant, but now the medium that we flow here is a stationary phase culture. Okay? So in the channels, we have also a bacterial culture that maintains the condition as in the beaker at stationary phase. Is it here? Okay. So, and the question, what are these bacteria doing? Are they just sitting there, or are they dying and growing? And the short answer is, this is a movie taken after a day of starvation, and this is about a two-day movie. And as you can see, what bacteria do there is that they don't do much. So of course, this you can see there is about there are a few percent of bacteria that do eventually lyse, and some of them that do eventually grow a little bit. But what the majority of the bacteria are doing is what you saw here. They're just frozen.
So how many hours have you been looking at?
So this is, I think, 2 days.
Yeah, I think how old is the medium?
So it's a stationary phase culture, so it's also a 2 day old culture.
What's a stationary phase culture in terms of its nutrients?
So we just let them exhaust the nutrients naturally. So we grow them in minimum medium with a little bit of amino acids, and that's it. And when they exhaust the amino acids, they stop growing.
If you were to spin out the bacteria and take that spent medium and put bacteria back in it, would they grow?
A little bit. This is why we don't flow spent medium in the microfluidic channel. If we do that, they grow a little bit. It's not really steady. It's not a steady state. But we really flow them with the culture itself.
So what limits growth then?
That's an excellent question. We don't know.
Excuse me? If you change the medium, would they all recover?
Yes. Yes. So they are not dead, if this is what you're asking. But the death in this medium is in this condition is very, really minor.
Sorry, have you tried 4 day medium?
Yes, so 4 day medium, yes. So we'll see. We go up to a few days. Why 4 days?
Well, I see slightly different things. The longer you go in stationary phase, with at least the gram positives. So I'm just trying to draw some analogies to this, but in richer medium.
Yeah, so in richer medium, you know, it's a mess, right? Because if you grow them in LB, right? In LB, the medium is supposedly buffered, but when they reach stationary phase, the pH goes up to 9, okay? And then, you know, they are at high pH, so definitely there is massive death in rich medium. But we wanted to have conditions, you know, starvation that we can study for quite a period of time. So what we wanted to ask about these non-growing bacteria that are just frozen there is, do they have any metabolic activity? And how is this metabolic activity spread on the population? And the easiest way to do it is just to have an inducible promoter, synthetic promoter controlling GFP. We starve them, we let them for 2 days at stationary phase, and then after that, when they are frozen for quite some time, we add the inducer, right? And we ask, are they going to turn on the GFP at all? We know that these synthetic promoters have been engineered and they are widely used to be induced at exponential phase. What is going to happen at stationary phase? So that's the question, do they respond to induction? So we start with bacteria that express the red fluorescent protein already from stationary phase. So they start on red, so just for visualization. And the question, are they going to turn on green? Yes, so we induce them after about 2 days of starvation, and you see that the green signal turns on, and it turns on in, again, This is what the majority of the population is doing. Some of the bacteria will not respond to the signal, but the majority population is responding to the signal and turning on the GFP. Okay? So they are gross arrested, but they are still able to respond to an external signal, transcribe RNA, and translate proteins.
So Nathalie, excuse me, how slow is this compared to how much time does it take for growing bacteria?
That's a good question. Okay, so how does it compare to the response at exponential phase? So first, before we get there, we wanted to know what is the dynamics of the response. And actually, our goal was really to have some characteristic time at station phase where eventually they need to stop responding to the signal because they don't grow, so they just accumulate the GFP, right? So we wanted to see whether there was some typical time for they to reach once you induce them to stop producing protein. And what was surprising is that at least for several hours, they read the signal, and these are different single cells, so different single cells have different induction levels. It's quite clear, but they respond very quickly to the signal, okay, at the same time. So as soon as you put APDD, they respond, and the response is linear. So it means that they just produce GFP at a constant rate. So on this time scale, at least, there is no saturation. They just accumulate more and more GFP.
So if you actually try to put numbers in and ask how many is it accumulating? How many proteins?
So how many proteins in terms of... Okay, we haven't put real numbers in yet.
But it's roughly known the number of ribosomes.
Yeah, so the number of active ribosome at station phase is actually not really known. What we can see is that because the response is linear, so this is a raw data, right? So we can, from the slope, we directly get the promoter activity, which is nice. And we can compare this promoter activity to the promoter activity of the same promoter at exponential phase, and it's 10 times lower.
This is a chromosomal fusion?
So here what is shown, and this is where you see this large variability, this is a plasmid, but we have it also on a chromosomal fusion, and it's the same behavior in terms of this linear slope. Now, once we saw that basically this is what the majority of bacteria is doing, they are responding to the signal at the same time and the signal is linear, there is no point in measuring it at the single cell level. And we wanted to extend the dynamic range in time also, so we moved to measuring this response in batch culture. And what we can do in batch culture is we can induce at different time points. Okay, so here we have a 96-well plate, and we grow the bacteria to station phase. So all the cultures are similar, probably. And at each time point, we induce a different well. Okay, so like that, we can compare a well that is induced at the beginning of station phase and a well that is induced after 3 days of starvation. Okay. So this is just a growth curve, and now in the gray area is more or less the exponential phase and the early entry into station phase. So you can see that when you induce the system at exponential phase, of course the system shoots up because bacteria are exponentially growing and therefore it's strong and rapid. And the question is what is going to happen once they settle into this station phase state? And what happens is the same as you saw in the microfluidic devices, the response is just linear, okay? So whether you induce it after 2 hours of station phase or after 5 hours of station phase, at this time scale it's linear, but now we can go on.
I'm sorry, Natalie, maybe I missed something, but what are the rows in the plate? So the columns are different durations already in stationary phase.
No, each well is a different duration, or each pair of well is a different duration.
I see, okay. So
We just automatically inject to a different well at different time.
Okay.
And what you can see here is that the response stays more or less constant over the several days at station phase. So we don't see here what we see, the small saturation that we see is due to evaporation, and when we correct for that, it's gone. And so if you measure the promoter activity, so promoter activity at exponential phase is normalized here to 1, it goes down at the onset oxidation phase, and then it remains constant at the at this 1/10 value for several days.
And so you mentioned, is it the plasmid or is it the chromosome?
So it's the same. Here on this one, I don't remember if this is a, but we have it both on plasmid and the chromosome. Also, it doesn't really depend on exactly which induction system you take. If you take a lambda-based promoter or a PTAC promoter, if you induce with IPTG, if you induce with ATC, it's the same.
So this is the average of the single well, right?
Yes, this is.
For the other graph, you showed with several slopes. Those are different cells from the same control.
Yes.
So there's variability.
There is variability. We were after studying the viability, but then we couldn't understand what the main culture was doing, and this is why we focused. We were really looking for a time constant of the order of hours and see the viability in this time constant, but it turns out that the bacteria are just sitting there, and it is as if they really enter a state that can really take them for a very long period of time at this reduced metabolism, yes.
Why is it so complicated?
Here, because here you have, I mean, we use GFP, and GFP has a degradation which is about a day, and then we are limited, so we don't take into account the data where the GFP is, degradation rate is important. Now, it's supposed to be 24 hours. What we see in this culture is that it varies. So it gets really messy.
But you just cut that curve off by hand, or no?
Yeah, we decide that, you know, about a few hours.
It up to some vertical level.
Yeah, we analyze only the beginning. What is important here is the beginning, because the time axis into station phase is comparing the initial response here to the initial response here.
When it's good, this is in when it's growing how fast in the exponential phase?
The growth rate here is about one division per hour.
So it's sort of strange. If I take a tenth of the amount of protein being produced just superficially, then it's like as if it was producing a cell's worth of protein once every 10 hours, something like that. It seems a huge rate for 1 minute. I presume it's producing a lot of the protein that would normally produce at high levels, but it's not producing much.
It's not producing, right. Everything is shut down, right? And in fact, what we do here is we artificially ask the cell to produce a protein that is not regulated and therefore and not needed, right?
Well, and also same
most
way.
Of the protein production there is shut down really by regulation, not just by the fact that the metabolism goes down. For example, here, clearly the number of ribosomes goes down, right? But in certain promoter, in most of the promoters that are of active growth, they are shut down more actively than just by reducing the number of ribosomes.
But it seems like teleologically here, the cell's doing a sensible thing. Like, it thinks IPTG is allolactose. And so you have to induce the lac operon if you're going to escape from stationary phase, so that all the housekeeping things should and probably are shut up. You've given the cell a sniff of a better future, and it's trying to respond.
Maybe what we're trying to say is that because you know it's the same response if you put ATC, so you could argue also it wants to protect itself. No, that's fine. But what seems to be here happening is that what we're measuring is really the basal metabolism of the cell. It doesn't seem to be really an active response in a sense, right? So we are measuring what is ability of bacteria along that to produce proteins at all.
That's not necessarily the basal metabolism, and with Andrew's comment, right? This is the ability to do it rather than,
right.
May not correlate very much with how much protein it's producing without the induction.
I mean, it seems like it'd be interesting to just sequence the RNA, and my guess is that for most housekeeping genes, the messenger RNA is almost totally vanished, like
yes.
Messenger RNA for ribosomal proteins.
Right, all the sigma 70 promoters are shut down.
If you change the limiting nutrient, I mean, are these carbon limited?
They're carbon limited, yeah.
And so that would go along with what Andrew's saying, right? That if you were nitrogen limited, they might not respond in the same way.
Maybe. So we, what, the next question we wanted to ask on these CASP bacteria, we call them CASP as an homage to GAS, which is constant activity stationary phase. So it's, we can also see whether they're just responding to the maximal of their abilities when we put an induction signal, and no. So the induction signal is still proportional to the response is proportional to the induction signal as you expect from the lack response. And actually, what is nice about it is that, as you can see from this curve, extracting a promoter activity from here is very precise, and it's a way to measure this response curve much more precisely than at exponential phase. But so, as I said, we are using an artificial promoter. We may argue that even this artificial promoter is considered as a metabolic response, but still, we may push the bacteria to produce protein when in a state where they don't want to produce proteins, and it might be a big burden to the cell. So what we wanted to understand, if we compare two cultures, one that was induced at stationary phase and produced GFP without growing for many hours, and one in the identical condition but did not respond to did not receive that PTG, what fitness difference will be between the two?
What promoters have you tracked? Because I'm wondering, so we think many promoters are not active in stationary phase. Right? So just because you removed the lac repressor doesn't make it obvious that now this promoter is obvious, that it should be on, right? So is a constitutively expressed promoter on in your system?
So this is what we see, that constitutive promoters are on. So whatever you do, so for example, the lac, we try two different kinds of lac promoter. One is that is engineered on the lambda promoter, right? And the lambda promoter with binding site for the lac, right? As soon as you take off the repressor with IPTG, the promoter is on. So back to the question of fitness, what do you measure on non-growing bacteria as a proxy for fitness?
Like
on-time survival.
Yeah, so you know, say again, you know, all these questions of fitness is really depending on what you want, what you expect the next environment to be, right, in a sense. So clearly viability is a measure of fitness, right? I mean, if cells are dying because they induce the GFP, then it's going to reduce their fitness. And so viability is definitely what we wanted to measure, but also what we wanted to ask is, and this is really philosophical, but we say, okay, bacteria at station phase, they want to maintain their viability, but the main goal is to be able to regrow as fast as possible once they are re-exposed to similar conditions, right? So viability in itself is not enough. We want to both measure viability and the ability of this culture to regrow. So this is more or less what you were saying, yes. And therefore, what we do is we very simply, we take the two culture, dilute them back into the initial medium, and let them regrow, and measure the regrowth of the two culture. And as you can see, that green one and the blue one here are these two cultures, and at least at the level of this sensitivity, we don't see any major effect, nor in viability, because viability will decrease the initial point here. It will start from different initial points, nor in the growth rate, nor in the ability to regrow. So despite the fact that the green culture here was producing GFP and the cells are very bright, after we wait for 30 hours, they are as bright as exponential phase cells. They produce GFP, but it has no major effect on the fitness.
Not to mean, it starts at 4.
No, because we dilute them quite a bit. So this is where you start seeing
things. You don't see anything.
Right.
But I guess this is where the absolute number of the protein in there chemistry is playing an important
it's
role.
It's playing an important role, right. So, well, yeah, so what we did evaluate, I don't think I have it here. No, I don't. What we did evaluate is what happens if we induce one protein, and now on top of it, we induce another one, okay, another system, which is very similar. What is going to happen to the first system? Is it going to decrease its production rate? Mm-hmm. And from this decrease in production rate, we can estimate how much of the production here is devoted to this artificial production compared to the production of the rest of the metabolism in the cell. And the estimate comes out to be about 10%. So they are producing proteins, but it's not that a big amount compared to the other production that they need to do for this maintenance at the stationary phase.
Natalie, are there mutants that still grow in the stationary phase?
Yes, so there are mutants.
You know, in principle, you could divide everything out.
Right, so that's a good point. So yes, if you take mutant of the stringent response, and this is something that we've started to do, yes, so the growth curve is not as nice as that. They stop, and then they regrow a bit, and then they stabilize again. It seems to be that they are also dying, so we are, it's more of a mess, but yes, clearly, this growth arrest, and this alludes to the question of Paul, what happens if you refit them with the same medium? The growth arrest here is an active growth arrest. So it really looks, and this is what the stringent response is about, right? There is an active break mechanism that really enables the cells to grow into this maintenance state, and this maintenance state now can go on for quite a bit.
I'm sorry, but I really I'm completely confused at how this can work. You're saying all constituent promoters are still just on and producing mRNA and producing protein, and you see this GFP that you just turned on go up and up and up and up and up, and the cells are not that big. So
right.
What's happening? It's just more and more and more and more protein can't be, right? It needs to be turned over. Right?
Okay, so clearly there is protein turnover, there is protein degradation. The turnover of the GFP is less than most of the proteins that are over there. But yes, I agree with you, there has to be protein turnover there. And actually it's known that there is protein turnover at stationary phase.
Because you said if you add now a second one, you can see how much you're spending on the first, but you're spending a lot on many, 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 many allergens, no?
Yes, yes. Well, no, well, by adding a second one, it's like, you know, it's like this resistor in series model, right? So by adding another one, right, you can actually estimate, and seeing its effect on the first one, you can estimate how much of the production machinery is actually devoted to doing something else. Okay, if you assume you have your ribosome, for example, and they are free to now you add actually here in parallel another production, you can see how it decreases the main production, and the estimate is that the GFP that we are making the cell do is about 10%, taking up 10% of the production machinery. Okay. That's
an
estimate.
What about if you measured colony forming units or viable cells?
So viability doesn't decrease over this period of time.
I just don't want to come back to these numbers on the protein. I mean, presumably there's a large amount of ribosomes in there, I mean, both RNA and amino acids, which aren't being used, which don't need them anymore. So presumably if there are breakdown processes going on, there's a large supply of things in the cell which aren't needed.
This might be the answer, that there is a large supply, and this large supply is used up as to maintain this very low but constant activity for a long period of time. But this very low, it's not, you know, we were expecting some continuous decrease of the activity, right? You enter station phase, you still have some food there, whether it's internal supply or external supply, but eventually it decreases and you don't produce anymore, you stop. And what we see is that it decreases abruptly to 10% of the production capacity, and then it stays constant for a few days, right? So it's a bit different than this idea of that you just use up
Maybe we should.
Okay, we should. Yes, we should move on. That's only. Yeah. So we're going back to Monod's curve. So we saw a little bit of stationary phase, but and we see there is an active mechanism for apparently stopping growth, despite the fact that there are both external and internal resources for growth. And now what goes on in the lag phase? In the lag phase, you actually put bacteria from the stationary phase back into fresh medium. There is plenty of resources. And the question is, why don't they start growing immediately? And the conventional answer is that, yes, it takes time to produce this enzyme. You know, it's like deoxic shift. It takes time to produce the enzyme that will enable you to be able to regrow again to exponential. So it's understood as a real metabolic bottleneck. Now, there what we wanted to see is actually the variability. So going back to single cells, how are single cell, what are they doing during the lag? Are they all arresting their growth and then suddenly starting to grow again, or is there some variability? Now, you have to realize that the measurement of the lag phase is typically done in batch culture, and people measure the time it takes from the dilution until exponential growth is established again. This is a bulk measurement, but it totally masks what is going on in the tail of the distribution of the lag, and this is something that we were interested in. So if we look at one strain of E. coli that has lag variability at an enhanced level, and this is very simple, it's E. coli taken from overnight culture and plated on rich medium again, then you can see the lag by defining how much it takes for a bacterium to just double. Okay, let's define this as a single cell lag. And as you can see, most of the bacteria have a short lag phase, but some of them really stay at this extended lag phase for a very long period of time. And if you quantify it, and in this particular mutant, what we see is really a bimodal distribution of lag phases. And here, you don't see it well, but it's a logarithmic scale. So the difference between the lag phase of this peak in the population and the lag phase of this bacteria is an order of magnitude apart. Okay? Now, if you had a population without this peak, and you would measure it in this population study, you wouldn't see these lagging bacteria because the growth would be dominated by the one that exits the phase fast and then grow exponentially.
So the scale's hard to read. What is the number under the left-hand V?
So this is about half an hour, and this is about 15 hours.
So with respect to phase, you put them on your plate with a rich medium, and as quickly as possible, put them on the electroscope, and then you start to grow.
But now here the quantification actually is not done by microscopy, because as you can see here, at least in this simple experiment, your time range is limited, because as soon as you have one that grows exponentially, you're done. So what we do, in order to measure it simply, and this is hopefully a setup that we'll have here, is and we'll play with it. We have office scanners, so just document scanners, on which we put petri dishes instead of documents. So all you need to do is know how to plate petri dishes. And what the document scanner is doing is it's taking images of the plates, and they're all hooked up to a computer. And eventually, we have also software that analyzes the appearance of colonies on plates and extracts the appearance distribution. So the idea here is that if you have a petri dish and you have plated your bacteria from a stationary phase, if a colony will start growing only a day later, you'll see the colony itself crossing a certain threshold of size only a day later. So the appearance time distribution is a proxy for the lag time distribution. Of course, there are some controls you need to do to be sure. For example, you need to see what we can see here is the each curve like that is like the area of a colony expanding on these petri dishes. So you see a colony that has started to grow here and a colony that has started to grow much later. So the time scale here, from there. So, but what you can see is that yes, colonies, this colony and this colony have appeared at very different times. Here, the time scale is about 5 hours every tick. But the expansion of the colony on the plate is parallel. So this is the first indication that it's a lag difference and not a growth rate difference. Okay, so why should we care about these bacteria that are at the tail of the lifetime distribution? And actually, we care about these bacteria since our interest in persistent to antibiotics, because actually, when you put bacteria in and you expose them to many antibiotics, antibiotics are not going to kill as efficiently bacteria that are at the lag phase. This is well known, but somehow totally ignored. So when people measure the response of bacteria to antibiotics, they typically don't tell you how far away they are from stationary phase. They started from an overnight culture, they dilute it, and usually they don't tell you for how long they waited or how many times they diluted. And there are always a tail of lagging bacteria there. And these lagging bacteria are not going to be killed as long as you treat them during the lag phase. And they are going to appear as persistent bacteria. So actually, the kill curve of bacteria reflects the lag time distribution of bacteria in most of the assays at our time. So, how do you see it? So yes, if you dilute a bacterial culture of an antibiotic, what we expect when we don't think about it too much is just an exponential decay. And when you have an exponential culture, the initial decay is actually pretty much exponential and fast. But if you wait long enough and do it for a long enough time, you see that after this exponential decay, you have a second decay here. And this decay, at least in this experiment, really reflects the time scale of the lag time distribution, of this tail of the lag time distribution. If you take bacteria from here and regrow them, you get exactly the same curve. So we are not talking about genetic resistance. And the hallmark of persistence is exactly that, the fact that the initial response of the population actually doesn't give you any clue to what the later response will be. And from what we have done with E. coli, this is what we can say. Most of the persistence that we see in all kinds of different strains is actually coming from the lag phase. So if you have a true exponential culture, if you really are careful enough to grow your bacteria in the chemostat, you won't see much of persistence. And therefore, it has to be really carefully specified when you measure persistence. And Bruce is not here, and it's a pity because there is this mafia, and he knows all about this mafia, that he's persistent everywhere, but he's not aware of the fact that most of the persistence is actually linked to the lag phase.
Sort of implicitly what you're saying is that the lag phase distribution doesn't change by adding the antibiotic.
Okay, that's a very good point. So this is what I say here, and for many antibiotics this is a case, but yes, the lag phase distribution may change when you add antibiotics, and even exponentially growing cell may respond to the antibiotic, right? This can happen, yes. And actually, in order to see that, I'll go briefly because this is old news, but in order to see that, so you can, in order to convince yourself that at least for the antibiotic that you are using, this is not the case. So here is a movie with two rounds of antibiotics. So we grow the cells, they die, it goes quickly. Then you see we wash away the antibiotics, some of them regrow, right? And then we do a second round of antibiotics, and you see that they are killed as efficiently. So here, this is just to show you that it's not resistant, right? And here, this is to show you, so these are bacteria that are grown to station phase, and then they are exposed to fresh medium and grown for a while. And here you can see there is a very faint bacterium, and when we wash away the antibiotic, this is a persistent one. It's going to regrow, but you can see that It was not growing already before the exposure to antibiotics, right? So at least in this system, it's not related. You can pinpoint which is going to, which bacterium is going to survive even before you expose it to antibiotics. Yeah.
The residual killing that you see in this this later in the second tail of the previous curve, that comes from bacteria going out of the lamp.
Exactly.
So in the lamp, they don't kill them at all.
So with this antibiotic in the lung phase, there's hardly any killing.
But is this antibiotic is inhibiting cell wall?
Yes. So this is ampicillin. Yeah.
And if one to inhibit ribosome function.
Okay. So what we tried is all kind of drugs that inhibit DNA gyrase. So and again, it's the same trick. If a bacterium doesn't grow, doesn't replicate its DNA, it's not going to be killed by this antibiotic. Now, for ribosomal protein, what happens is either you have a bacteriostatic antibiotic on the but with a ribosome chlorpheniprole or tetracycline. And then, you know, you can't define persistence for bacteriostatic antibiotic because as long as you don't, as soon as you take away the drug, they all grow back. So it's for the aminoglycosides, which are the second class of antibiotics that target the ribosome and are killing the bacteria, there, at least in our system, we don't see this persistence anymore. So they are able to kill these non-growing bacteria, not as efficiently. So there are minute differences, but not as dramatically as for the DNA gyrase inhibitor or for the cell wall inhibitors.
Then, just with regards to bacteriostasis and bactericide now, it becomes a bit difficult to understand when you have a drug that can be bacteriostatic against one bacterium and bactericidal against another bacterium, if we have a universal response to these types of drugs. What do you think about that? What do you say about the variable response to a given antibiotic?
So, you know, this story of bacteriostatic and bactericidal, clearly it's about irreversibility. For example, if you have a drug that enters the cells irreversibly, and there are some antibiotics like that, right? For example, some antibiotics enter the cell, right? And then they are using actually a component of the cell to be altered, and then their diffusion back is changed, right? So these antibiotics will accumulate in the cell. Now you wash away the antibiotic from the medium, but it's still there in the cell, and therefore it's irreversible, and it will be bactericidal. But the same drug that is not going to be altered in its diffusion in another bag will be bacteriostatic, because once you wash it away, it goes. So it's really a matter of the time constant of the interaction of the of the antibiotic with the bag, and this can change between different bacteria. Okay, so what was postulated in this lag variability, if you know this, for example, this bimodal lag variability, is that it's a bad hedging strategy. Namely, if you have a uniform population of cells growing exponentially and having a very narrow lifetime distribution, they'll all grow, and they'll be sensitive to all kinds of stresses, for example, antibiotics, but not only. We see that also prophages are targeting growing cells much better than non-growing cells. And if you have this lagging bacterium that stays there dormant, it will stay dormant for a certain period of time and will enable to survive a stress as long as the stress is transient. And this bad hedging strategy is actually has been selected for evolution. But as clearly as we have argued for many years, there is no proof for that, right? And actually, Bruce has just written an article saying that this is not the case. That persistence is just, you know, just an artifact of defective metabolism, in a sense, right? And it has not evolved.
Well, it's not necessarily defective metabolism.
No, but generally,
I think that's what we try to argue.
It's more persistent as stuff happens, right? To be polite.
But it's a reasonable hypothesis.
It's a very reasonable hypothesis. It's a very reasonable hypothesis, and it was very important to state it up front. But it was equally important to try and see whether we can say, we can answer this question, is really lung variability, is the fact that the bacterium extend its life something that can evolve? Can a bacterium extend its life, lung time, in response to an environmental constraint? And how do you answer this question?
It's one of these things, right? There is a famous Dutch soccer player who once said, there's an advantage hiding in every discipline.
Right.
Maybe like that, right? And then both, in a sense. Stuff happens, but then sometimes stuff happens.
I mean, even right. If they're responsible for stuff happening, if they use one
why is the story?
The stochastic switching might be an adaptive response to fluctuating environments.
Yeah, so it was a bad hedging to.
But what evolution, what stuff evolution might happen is a bottom line side of the question. What the reason for it is not.
But that's probably what
story.
Talk
about.
Yeah. So, how do you do that? And this is actually the PhD work of Ofer Friedman that you have met here. And really, to answer this question, the idea was, can we say that, and you can see at the theoretical level that such a strategy would be beneficial in a fluctuating environment. And for example, if you expose your cells for a transient period each day to antibiotics, in principle, it would be good for them to have this extended lag time. So the question was, can we extend the lag time just by exposing the cells to antibiotics every day, or are they going just to turn on resistance and this is much more likely to happen? Okay, so this is experiment. You grow them to stationary phase, you dilute them directly into antibiotics, right? This is important. Then you wash away the antibiotic after, for example, 3 hours, let them regrow, and do that again every day. So this is what's going on. You kill them during a certain period of time, 3 hours, you wash away the antibiotic, they regrow, and then they have this stationary phase until you dilute them again. So after enough cycles, the death in the antibiotic period was very reduced, very much reduced. So if we had about the 5 log decrease in viability in the first round, after a few cycles, we are just down to about a factor of 2 or 3, and then we stop the treatment because then we can hardly see anything happening.
How many bacteria in every, what's the population size?
So the population size is 10 to the 9.
Just tell us the generation times and population.
Okay, so the generation time here is a half an hour.
Right.
Okay. The population size is 10 to the 9.
This is in within the flask and the.
It's in the flask.
What medium?
In LV.
So
we didn't want, them to adapt to a new medium. In LV, we know that,
Time of growth to stationary phase.
Okay, the time in stationary phase. So here, this is a defined period. This is really the time that is set, 3 hours, let's say. And the whole period is 24 hours, okay? So as they die less, and this is what is tricky about counting generation, for example, they die less, they will grow and reach stationary phase first, and then they'll have a longer stationary phase. Okay?
So still what happens? So the flask is what volume? So you add antibiotic, you've got what?
Yeah, no, it is important because what happens is that if you don't dilute the culture enough, and in order to you need to dilute about 1 to 50, okay? So what we do, and we don't want a huge drift, so what we do is we grow them in a small flask, 1 ml, two station phase, this is the 10 to the 9. And then we dilute it in a big flask,
which is
50 ml. Okay? And then they are exposed really to the antibiotics without any, leftovers.
How long do you need to grow? And that
And then we further die, okay? And how many generations they will regrow depends on how much they die, okay?
But you let them grow first before you add antibiotics.
No, antibiotics. We dilute them directly in fresh medium with antibiotics.
And then antibiotics, so
right.
A lot of death.
And so how long is this purple time then?
So yeah. This purple time is for the sake of the beginning, it's 3 hours. Okay. That this is a time that is
so
really
then you
safe.
Collect them all. So what number of cells do you collect and go into the next 1 mil?
So it really here we collect them all.
Yeah,
right, we wash them.
Very
and
few to begin with.
At the beginning it's very few.
And then they can
and then
regrow.
They regrow to this 10^9.
In 1 mil.
In 1 mil.
And then overnight in one they don't grow overnight?
Right.
They just stick.
But it's a short overnight compared to what I've shown before. Okay? So it's less than 24 hours.
Mean,
right?
Sorry? Shifting the mean of the lifetime. I mean, you're not really testing the dead headship, right? You're
no, we are just. The lifetime. Whether gross arrest in general can be a strategy that you want to. Yeah, I completely agree with you.
Yeah.
This was the first thing we wanted to test. Yes.
But last question. How much antibiotic?
Very high. So persistence, and this is also an important point. Right, in order to get the reproducible results and not get seeing persistence everywhere where it's not, is actually defined at very high concentration of antibiotics where the concentration doesn't matter anymore. Right? If you are sensitive to the concentration of antibiotics, it means that what you're measuring actually is some kind of resistance, right? If you are sensitive to if persistence and tolerance, and here what we'll see is evolution of tolerance. What is the difference between resistance and tolerance, right? The difference between resistance and tolerance is that resistance is the sensitivity to a concentration of antibiotics. So a strain is more resistant to another strain if it's MIC or whatever you measure as, but something that has units of concentration of antibiotics is this factor is different. So a strain is resistant to 100 microgram of antibiotic per ml and the other one to 10, right? And the one resistant to 100 will be more resistant. So it's a continuous scale. You don't say a strain is resistant, it's just more resistant than others. Now, tolerance means that the bacteria are able to survive for a certain amount of time. Okay, and therefore what characterizes tolerance is as per units of time, okay? It's a typical time that a bacterium can survive under high enough antibiotic concentration where this antibiotic concentration is not relevant. Okay? So this is why we use antibiotic concentration that is really very high and doesn't really, and then everything doesn't depend on the details of this concentration anymore. Okay. So, but has resistance evolved, right? So how do you measure resistance? This is the assay that Bruce has shown. There is a disc here with some concentration, with some amount of antibiotic, and this amount diffuses through the disc to the medium. This is the most surprising technique that we actually, you know, it's very surprising that it works, and it's we don't think it's really quantitative anyway, but what happens is that there is diffusion of antibiotics, so there is a gradient of concentration of antibiotics as you move away from the disc. Bacteria are plated everywhere, and in the high antibiotic region, they don't grow, and you see this halo, okay? And people measure the diameter of this halo, and they infer a sensitivity. So when you have something that is clearly resistant, it will grow all up to the disc, so this is clearly resistant compared to that. So just for as a visualization, it's good, but we don't think it's very quantitative, despite what the companies that sell this disc will tell you. And when we look at the ancestral strain and the bull strain, the one that is hardly dying in antibiotics, you see that the halo is the same size, it's even slightly bigger, and this is, and we understand why. So, but resistance has not evolved. And if you measure the MIC by whatever technique you want to measure it, the MIC did not change. So no resistance. So it means that, you know, if it's not, and when we look at the kill curve, the bacteria are not growing in these antibiotics. They are dying, but they are dying slower. This is the measure of tolerance, they can sustain a longer duration of the treatment, the concentration is not relevant here. And sometimes tolerance has been linked to the fact that bacteria just grow more slowly, right? But if you measure the exponential growth rate of the evolved strain, it's the same as Edition, and to cut a long story short, you can already guess that what has changed is the lag time, okay? So if we look at single cells, the ancestral, you will make colonies quite readily, and with the evolved strain, when we take a clone, and now we are not talking about the batch culture anymore, we're just picking clones, because what happened in all the population that we evolved is that the population was dominated by one clone that was genetically different, and when you take it, you see that it has a longer lag, even when you grow it in the absence of antibiotics. Okay, so, and another clue, another sign that it's not due to some resistance or some the decreased sensitivity is that the increased sensitivity, if you dilute, if you take your inoculum from stationary phase, then the evolved strain has an advantage of at least three orders of magnitude compared to the ancestral. But if you don't take an inoculum from stationary phase when you put into two antibiotics, but you grow it exponentially in a chemostat and then you expose it to, then the advantage is completely lost.
Can I ask again about the resistance? It is surprising, as you're saying, that you don't get resistant mutants evolving. If you put a resistant mutant in, presumably it will...
No, it will take over the population.
Right. So why don't you get resistant mutants evolving? It suggests to me there's very few generations going...
No, clone difference is a much bigger effect by doing this leg phase. That could do it, right? Bigger fitness effect, it'll
Well, the other is that there are not many generations of evolution.
There are about, we estimated it to 300 generations.
Each cycle?
No, not each cycle, total.
But most of those would be very early on, wouldn't they, I presume? Because once you've got a...
Not that early on, but even.
It's not going to be really any, you just would continue to enrich for
so
longer than 3 hours.
Of course, if we had a larger population size, we may have resistant mutants.
But you're also using very high levels of antibiotic, right?
Right.
Typically, when people evolve resistance, they do it as sort of step.
Exactly. What I'm saying is,
experiment. Clearly,
if we had the lower level of antibiotics, we would get resistant. This is the level of this is a typical concentration of that you use both in the clinic, if you believe the plasma level, and in the lab also. This is 100 mic per minute.
But
in
these fluctuation tests, you can get resistance.
Right, but not with not with penicillin, right?
You
are using with the clever. You are careful to use the antibiotics for which the resistance rate is pretty high. The target size is quite low.
I see.
But Nathalie, you're working with a beta lactamase null mutant, right? I mean, you don't.
The wild type.
Yeah.
So the wild type is so there is AMC on the chromosome, right?
Okay.
But it's not. It's too weak to be resistant.
So you would anticipate maybe a duplication or a number of duplications?
Yeah, this was also something that could have happened, but it didn't, right?
So there was a question here.
You're too polite.
So about the transparency of the halo, that's the same? Don't get involved with transparency.
Of the halo, yeah. Yeah, it's transparent, yes. Yes, well, we don't, But again, you know, this halo, that's the question is, you take an exponentially growing culture and you plate it, and then, this is one. Okay, so, of course, the question, so the first indication that, yes, the lag extension can evolve in such a setup, right, and it seems to be driven by the environment. But the final proof that it's really driven by the environment is instead of 3 hours now. So when we did it with 3 hours, it didn't escape our attention that the mean lag time of the evolved strain was 3 hours. Right. So we repeated the experiment with 5 hours and 8 hours, and with parallel line. And again, within enough cycles, the survival to the ampicillin treatment was very high. No resistance has evolved,
no difference in growth rate again, and again it was the lambda distribution which we can measure with the ScanLab system. So this is the ScanLab measurement of the endpoints, so of the majority clones in all in the population. So here is the lifetime distribution of the ancestral strain, and you see that. So here the time is shifted to the time at which you see a colony. So 10 actually means that this is where we start seeing the colony, but the lab, the typical lifetime that we measure under the microscope of the ancestral is about 45 minutes. And the width is about 45 minutes as well. Now, the strain that is evolved, the green strain, is evolved under 3 hours of antibiotic treatment. You see that the lifetime distribution is not only slightly shifted, but it's much wider. 5 hours of antibiotic treatment is the red one, and 8 hours of antibiotic treatment is the blue one, which is really spread over many, many hours. And clearly, if you do a very simple model where you say, okay, the ones that stay in a non-growing state, they are protected from the antibiotics, so they don't die. As soon as they switch to the growth state, they die into antibiotics, but the reverse fitness is happening when there is no antibiotic. The one that is non-growing has a fitness disadvantage, it's not growing. The one that is growing has a fitness advantage. And if you just take one parameter, you adjust just one parameter, this switching rate of the lag, and you ask what is the optimum switching rate in the experimental condition that we put it, then not surprisingly, you would have this lifetime distribution increasing, and you want to put as many cells, if this is the timing of the antibiotic treatment, these cells are going to die, these cells are going to survive, you want to shift as many cells as you want as you can after the antibiotic treatment, but you don't want to shift them to too long time because under the non-antibiotic regime, they will have a disadvantage. So
where did the bimodality go?
Yeah.
What?
The first distribution of lactam is bimodal, right?
Yeah, no, this would be under a different regime of selection. And here we're just selecting for long life.
No, but before you're selecting, you have the lactam.
Where was it bimodal?
Like the first.
Here? This one?
No.
The first one is a mutant. Is a mutant.
Oh, is
okay.
It?
Yeah. But it was a special strain of E. coli that does it at a much higher level. So in the wild type, there is a small peak here. When you plot it on the log scale, you can see that there is a bimodal tail here, but it's not apparent on this scale.
And it was much broader. It was like one order of
magnitude. Right. So this very simple model tells you that the optimal lifetime duration should go linearly with the antibiotic treatment duration of in your environment, and this is more or less what happens when we plot the mean lifetime of the evolved strain. So they follow that. What happens is that, and we call it tolerance by lag to make it clear that the tolerance is due to the lag time. And they have adapted to the duration of treatment, not to its precise chemical nature. So if we now expose these strains to another antibiotic, the DNA gyrase inhibitor, nofloxacin here, so you see that compared to the ancestral strain, they all have a very big survival advantage also to an antibiotic to which they are not evolved. Clearly, when you take the inoculum from stationary phase again.
The genetic basis for this?
Tolerance by lag genes. Yes, so we sequenced those strains. We were expecting mutation all over the place, but so we don't have a huge statistics of lines, but what we see is mostly three genes, one toxin-antitoxin module, which is not very characterized, it's a toxin-antitoxin module, and all the mutations, so it's hit several times in different lines, so with different durations, and the mutation is in the antitoxin, And so this is one gene that was hit. Another one is the methionine pyrimidine synthetase. This is one hit, the G. It's an essential gene, so the mutation is not deactivating the gene. It's probably doing something else. And the last one is ribose, phosphate dehydrogenase. It's also a metabolic gene, also an essential gene, but we have no real clue how it's related to the lag. What we do have a clue of how it's related to the lag, and it was, and is a toxin-antitoxin module. It really fit into our previous work surprisingly well. So, what are toxin-antitoxin modules? Toxin-antitoxin modules were first seen on plasmids. I guess you've heard about the toxin-antitoxin module on plasmids. No. So, what happens is that one of the maintenance system of plasmid is the fact that the plasmid has a promoter that produces continuously a toxin, something that is toxic to the cell, in red here, and an antitoxin, something that either binds to the toxin or to its mRNA, but prevents the toxic action of the toxin. That's the idea. So the plasmid is making the cell continuously produce both of them. The antitoxin is short-lived. So if the plasmid is lost, as in this bacterium, the plasmid is lost, the antitoxin is going to be degraded very rapidly. The cell will be left with just toxin and will die or not divide. So this is called an addiction module, because once you have this toxin, this toxin-antitoxin system, you cannot lose it without dying. So it's really well understood on plasmid. What is less understood is why do almost all bacteria have so many toxin-antitoxin systems also on their chromosome. And the first one that was discovered on the chromosome is a Mazi system, Mazé. And for those who understand Hebrew, Mazé means what the hell is that? and I think we still don't have a good answer to this question, right? Basically, we don't know what toxin-antitoxin are doing on the chromosome. In the TB bag, there are about 90 of those. And the one we've been studied before this evolution experiment was the HEAP toxin-antitoxin module. And this is a mutant in the toxin, which has this high bimodality. And why do these modules, is their relation to lag is very clear. Actually, at least in our hands and in this system, when you induce the toxin to low level, what happens is that it has a long lag. So we can see it with the scanner system. So these are different levels of induction of the toxin. And as you can see, it goes from the narrow lifetime distribution to a distribution with a shoulder, and then eventually to a really very, very long lag. So the toxin is doing that. How it does it is by triggering in the astringent response and inhibiting the glutamate pyrimidine synthetase. So this toxin-antitoxin module actually gives us two clues of two targets that we got in the evolution experiment. One, the toxin-antitoxin, a different one. But secondly, an amino acid pyrimidine synthetase was another target, and they all belong to the same pathway of astringent response and growth arrest that is actually triggered by toxin-antitoxin. So the HEPA toxin, at least, we didn't study yet the new toxin-antitoxin system, but with the HEPA toxin, we see that it extends the lag by mimicking starvation. So you add the toxin, and the cell behaves as if it's starved and goes into this extended lag. And why do we get variability of lag time? As in this distribution I showed you in this mutant of the toxin-antitoxin system. Again, this is exactly the same mechanisms the student of Rich Lozick and Johan Paulson showed you, is basically you have two components. One of them is doing something here. It's creating a long lag, and the other one binds almost irreversibly and prevents this lag. And the question of just this very strong and irreversible interaction gives you this nonlinearity that creates a threshold here. So as long as you don't express enough antitoxin, enough toxin to be above the antitoxin level, then nothing happens. You have more antitoxin than toxin. And only when you reach this threshold, you can start feeling the antitoxin again. And this is exactly how HIP toxin-antitoxin module is behaving. And so what happens with toxin-antitoxin is you have this subtraction of these two very large numbers, number of toxin, the number of antitoxin. You are either at the toxin wins or the antitoxin wins. When you the antitoxin wins, you don't have growth arrest and you have these narrow peaks. When you are at the threshold, you start seeing either bimodality or this peak here that you can see is, I don't know if I have, yeah. You can see that in the red you have these two time constants, the fast time constant and the long time constant, okay? So this is what happens when you are at the threshold, and when you are above the threshold and the toxin wins, you have this long distribution of lag time, and this is where you are tolerant. So tolerance, as we see in the evolution experiment, is when this lag time distribution is shifted. Persistent would be the coexistence of both a short time scale and a long time scale. Here we really control the HIPA level artificially with a plasmid. Okay, so this is why we can move continuously from here to here.
So in your HIPA, you call your VAT-BC mutant.
So now we will probably do it also for the VAT-BC mutant.
But is that, that's now fixed in a, does that show a bimodal distribution?
No, not.
So it's not showing so a stochastic.
The one that is the majority clone is behaving very much like this one. Okay, so what we think is happening in this mutation that it's altering the levels of the toxin antitoxin far above the background. We have one mutant that does seem to behave as the bimodal, but it's not a majority clone, and rightfully so, because if you think theoretically, the regime of stress that we apply is actually selecting. For not selecting for bimodality.
No,
you are not better off with bimodality. What is selecting, what I showed you is the optimal, if you allow just one parameter to characterize your distribution, typically if you have an exponential distribution. So, but if you allow for two, basically the best solution of our antibiotic treatment for the cell would be to take the wild-type distribution and to shift it to exactly the point where the antibiotic is washed out, right? You want to maximize the density of cells that exit the lag exactly when you take off the treatment. And this is not what they're doing. They are spreading off their beds.
How much more time do you need?
How much more time do I have?
Okay. Yeah, well, we have another talk before 12, right?
Okay, so I'll wrap it up. But this is basically it. So with the toxin-antitoxin module, we can really understand how you can tweak that, and we also understand why it's not shifting the distribution, but why wasn't the best theoretical solution found by the bacteria, we don't know.
Well, why wasn't it already pre-existing? I mean, in the sense that if it's evolved, if there's an invisible back-aging mechanism, then
I'll go to the summary. Yes. So at least what we can see is that clearly, this growth arrest duration is not only. I mean, is really something that you can evolve, and you can evolve it quite quickly, not by selecting for the lag. So we didn't really say, okay, let's take the bacteria that have a long lag and let's grow them again. We evolve them under conditions that are pretty much conditions that occur also in the clinical setting when we take antibiotics, right? We take antibiotics, they're washed away in a couple of hours, and we take again another pill, and again. So what we are trying to see, if we have these tolerance by lag mutations actually occurring in patients, that would be nice to see, and whether in general clinical isolate have some longer lag than what we expect from the lab strains, which were clearly selected for a short lag. So thank the people who did the work, the most important. So the whole evolution experiment was done almost single-handedly by offer, and he started his PhD without any clue of how long it would take. constant stationary phase state was done by Ulrich Geffen, as well as all the microfluidic publication in the lab. And Irit Levine is the one that set up the SCANAC system, and she really worked hard to make it user-friendly, which is not characteristic of the software that we usually develop in the lab. So we do hope that it will be useful for that other people. Thank you.
So maybe you have a few more questions from sort of the junior people in the room, right? So the gentleman in the first row has to ask that.
So I don't know if you're aware, but there's an E. coli mutant with which you can basically trigger a stationary phase effect, and they go into a quiescent state. And it's been shown that people use these things in biotechnology to pump out protein. I don't know whether the stuff you were seeing with the continued protein production is really just some sort of, clearly they go into stationary phase before they need to, and that's a sort of quorum sensing effect, right?
It's not clear that it's quorum sensing, we don't know what the signal is there. It might be that they measure, you know, the derivative of the nutrient concentration, and then they go. We don't know.
Well, there's. I'm just thinking of this one mutant, and there's another mutant that I know of.
So it's a mutant of E. coli.
Yeah. It's in the HNS.
HNS.
Yeah.
HNS is like histone-like.
Yeah.
Okay.
And there's another mutant. If you knock out tryptophanase.
Okay.
Then stationary phase happens much, much later. Like they just don't seem, they seem to run into a wall.
Yeah, also if you knock down RPOS, they would typically grow more than here. Also, the stringent response. Yes, but this HNS mutant is interesting. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Look it up. Thanks.
Mina.
So the mutations that you saw in your genotype, I think, are strange. So, for toxin and antitoxin, are they like changing the expression of the protein that
we don't know? We don't know yet. Actually, they are all located. So each time it's a different mutation, but they are all located in the DNA binding domain of the antitoxin.
So it just changes the.
So according to the model imprint, if you believe it.
Mm-hmm.
What should be affected in order to shift the balance would be the degradation time scale of the antitoxin. If you make it shorter, then you alter the balance, but you don't get bimodality. This is what we think is happening. We need to measure it. So
if you change the binding between the
if you change the binding also,
yeah.
But then you should see also some coexistence of time scale. It really depends where you are relatively to the threshold. It could be also the binding.
Anybody else? Here.
So maybe I missed it, but so when you, because you didn't see any effect on the growth rate in log text, right? So that would mean that at some point you have to shift the whole, if you come out of log text, you have to shift it back so that the toxin is not in the trigger. So how do you envision that
actually
happening, so that you have a control on
actually? Right, so for toxic antitoxin system, what happens is that the degradation of the antitoxin is enhanced at stationary, at the onset of stationary. So this is why, you know, when they produce it continuously, they produce more antitoxin than toxin, but at the onset of stationary phase, the degradation rate of the antitoxin is shifted to a shorter period, and then you have this accumulation of the toxin.
And then this is what we think is if you put it into fresh medium, it switches back. So what?
Then when you put it into fresh medium, it's not clear how you get rid of this dentate. What we think is happening is actually, and we show it for the Cas bacteria, actually, bacteria are not like spores. I mean, the non-growing casping bacteria is not explored, and when they are in this growth arrest, very quietly, they still produce protein. What we think is happening is that they still produce the toxin antitoxin. Now the antitoxin is not degraded anymore, right? And eventually it gets them out of this lactate. The dynamics fit, because then you expect a linear increase of the lag phase with the amount of toxin and not a logarithmic one, if it was depending on the degradation of the toxin, but yeah, this is what I think you have.
Okay, so we have a 10-15 minute break and then we can meet for a start.